The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you. Thanks very much. It's great to be introduced in the library. I was a literary lion of the New York Public Library, and which was really nice. Had to rent a tux and everything, but that's all right. It was a good cause. And this library is a good cause, too. I hope you're going to all be generous in the building of a new one there. This is not a great time to be generous, I know, but I'm going to put in $5 as I leave here. New York Public Library, they had the 10th anniversary Literary Lions dinner. So they had in the past been like 20 writers for each Literary Lions dinner. And so this time there were 200. And we all had to be introduced. And, Meryl Streep once said one profound thing she said was in addressing the, is this good? Are you getting the, are you hearing me okay? Louder? Okay. No, they don't want. Every other word I'll be loud and then I'll. How's this? Is this a happy medium? All right. Good. They didn't hear it back there. They don't know whether it's good or not. Okay, if you don't hear me, hold up your hand. What was I talking about? Meryl Streep said once that in addressing, I think it was the Yale graduating class, she said that you're going out into real life now, and you'll find that real life is not like college. Real life is like high school. But sometimes the literary life sometimes is like grammar school because it reminded me so much of like the third grade when we would line up in the hall for before lunch, you know, to go into the lunchroom. All of us literary lions were lined up there in the hall to this big glittery dining room, and we were lined up alphabetically, which is... it's kind of fun to see, it's interesting anyway, to see where you stand, you know, alphabetically. I was between Harold Bloom and Judy Bloom. And Judy and I got along fine, but Harold and I just didn't hit it off. I'm glad they got applause. If it had been the other way around, I doubt there would have been applause. Harold Bloom had written written the introduction to a book called The Book of Jay, which is somebody had found some Dead Sea Scroll or something, which is supposed to be the text from which many religious books had been taken, and including the Bible. And Harold Bloom had theorized that the author of this ancient text was a woman because the figure of Yahweh was so obnoxious. And I said to him, that must be a good way to meet women. Say that, I'm the guy who has suggested that a woman made up the Almighty. But he said, no, I had gotten that was not the point of it at all. I had missed the point, and so we didn't have anything to say to each other. And this was happening, unfortunately, all up and down the line. I mean, T's were not hitting it off with other T's, and... therefore, we're wandering over into the G's, maybe, and so on and so forth. P's amongst the Y's, I don't know. And there was a man there in the front at the front of the line who, as there always is a guy with a clipboard, you know, who has to keep things orderly. And he was looking through the door into the dining hall and shushing us. You know, you sort of hate to be shushed when you're a... literary line, but, good cause and everything. We could see he had a problem because he would see us get out of line and he would say, people, I can't do this. And so we would all shuffle back into line. And he was peeking through the door and quieting us, and then when it was the time for one of us to go through, he would push us out the door into this. And I was, as a bee, was fairly early when I went out, and I had been told where to go to my table, and I was heading there. And then I heard the voice of Barbara Walters saying, and now a humorist and novelist. And I thought, oh, that's cool. Barbara Walters knows I wrote a novel. I just wrote one, and that's nice. But then she said, and incidentally, a very good cook. And I couldn't figure out what the, I've done lots of things at night that I don't remember. One time in New Orleans, I woke up in the hotel room and went into the restroom, and you don't call it a restroom in your room, do you? I went into the bathroom and looked in the mirror, and there was a big glob of dried blood right in the middle of my forehead. And for the life of me, I couldn't remember. I could remember doing several things the night before, but I couldn't remember having been shot. And, you know, when you're a writer, you kind of hate not to remember those things because it's material, you know. But then I looked a little closer, and, of course, I hadn't been shot. I had just slept on my complimentary mint. I can tell that you've all been there. Yeah. Yeah. So, but as I say, there are things I've forgotten that I did, but I couldn't imagine that I had ever cooked for Barbara Walters. You know, first time I'd seen Barbara Walters, as well as I could recall, in the flesh. And anyway, I mean, I can cook a little bit, but the kind of food that Barbara Walters is used to, I doubt she would single me out as a good cook. And so I was nonplussed as I went toward my table until I heard Barbara say, Nora Ephron. And everybody applauded, and I sat down and went all the way through the alphabet, and every person was wrong. And people just, halfway through the alphabet, Tony Randall took over, and he got everybody wrong too. We had gotten unalphabetical. It happens. At one point, he said George Plimpton, and a tiny Indian woman walked out, and everybody just applauded. You know, so that's literary recognition for you. I was also in a library in a little town in Mississippi, and I went up to the, I was visiting, passing through town, and I went up to the desk, the information desk, and I said, in front of me were an elderly white man and a young black woman. And the elderly white man, a term I feel more and more every day I'm entitled to use, was saying to the person at the desk, well, I just felt like I needed a piece of pie. And I said to myself, Walter, where would you get a piece of pie this time of day? Because Ms. Boyd has extremely fine pie, but she's not open. And the woman behind the desk said, this time of day. I know. But so I said to myself, Walter, what you could do, you could go over to the library and ask them if they knew where I could get a piece of pie this time of day. And the lady said, yeah, this time of day. And she said, oh, my goodness. Laura, she hollered to somebody in the stacks, do you know where Mr. Fountain can get a piece of pie? And a faint voice from the back said, you mean this time of day? And at that point, the young black woman stepped forward and said, excuse me, do you have anything about the army? Because I got to get out of this damn town. I'm sure no one has ever said that about Philadelphia. It's great to be here. And this new book I have here is called Alphabet Juice because it seems to me that the juiciness of words has been neglected by linguistics. There is a tenet of linguistics amongst serious linguisticians that relationship between a word and its meaning is arbitrary. And I just think that's crazy. Linguisticians will say, there are obvious onomatopoeic words like pop and snap and crackle, but they don't really count. And so then they can move on. Linguistics can move on to address universal human grammar, which is just too abstract for me. It just seems to me that money has gotten too abstract, for instance, and that's why it all went away recently. The more you can tie language and money and food to actual things, food, for instance. Somebody asked me once, I was on the radio and had to come up with a quick answer, said, what's your favorite word? And there's just so many nice words, but I said chicken. Because it's just one thing, chicken is a fun word to say. You know, it's got that K in there. When you go to a horse or to someone you're attracted to, it's with different things in mind. You want the horse to go and the person you're attracted to come over or allow you to come. But so that K works. But so I said chicken. And I'll stand by that. But there's something about chickens, too. And what I don't like is chicken fingers. And, because chickens don't have fingers. Chicken, young people probably don't know that because they get in fact, there was a man at the University of Georgia, a professor of, I forgot what his title is, but, he figured out a way to turn all dark meat of chicken into white meat of chicken. I don't know who asked him to do that, but he, what he does, he puts chicken in a centrifuge and spins it until it turns into a liquid and then takes out all the dark stuff and then cuts it into sort of chunks, I don't know, fingers or something, or faux drumsticks or something, and freezes them. And, I guess he freezes it first and then cuts it into shape. And so if you buy it at the store and take it home and cook those frozen cut-out chicken glop things, they, I guess, are sort of like chicken. But if you leave them out on the counter, they will just melt and turn into chicken glop. And that seems to me to be, it's chicken too distantly derived. And I'm not a vindictive person, but I sort of wish that this scientist would wake up some morning and the first thing he would feel and the second thing he would feel in putting his feet into his slippers would be melted chicken. But never mind that. But so, I think words have lots of physical integrity to them. Not all words do. The word, in fact, onomatopoeia doesn't really do anything for me. Lots of words taken from the ancient Greek don't really resonate. But I came up with a better term, I think, for onomatopoeia, which is sonicky. I think that it's got that K in there for one thing, and it's sort of more. It's not just words like snap, crackle, and pop. It's words. I'll give you an example. I was reading along somebody's book about words, and he said that the word urinate comes from the Latin word urinari, which was the educated scholarly word for urination, for to urinate, but that the vernacular word amongst Latin-speaking people in ancient Rome was pisse, which is, and he said, that's a much more onomatopoeic word. And I was, and words that come up from vernacular are bound to be more onomatopoeic because people, people sort of make things up and they're not, they're less abstract when they when they come from the street. But then it occurred to me that actually the word piss isn't onomatopoeic unless it's onto a hot rock. But it does have a kind of physical appropriateness, I think, which is that it starts with a tight P, you know, pursed lips. Pursed something, I don't know. And it starts out tight, and then it just releases, you know, piss. I think there are a lot of words like that, maybe it's just coincidental. But to take the word through, I love to think about words that we take for granted. You know, there are lots of books about antique words and weird words and quaint words and long words interesting histories, and I have some of that in this book too. But I like to take another look at words like through. The word through goes right straight through your mouth. It starts out in the front and goes back, all the way back, and then sort of goes at the end. It's like shooting, you know what a shotgun house is? When you shoot, shotgun house is one that's just one room after another in a line. So if you fired a shotgun through it, it would go all the way through every room. Only this would be a shotgun house with with the back door locked. So it bounces back a little bit. The through comes back out. But compare through, which moves so clean, so fluidly through the mouth. Compare it to the word thwart, which starts out like through, but then suddenly that W jumps in there, and you got to sort of double clutch, and then it ends in a T. Lots of words that have to do with stopping and coming to rest end in T. So I've got a whole long list of them here. And also the word throttle. Think about the word throttle. It starts out like through, but then it gets back in the back of your mouth, that sort of evokes choking. And that makes sense to me that's nobody knows what the first word was, of course. But I think the second word was, huh? That in fact, is a word that has saved my marriage because we never hear each other right the first time. And, for instance, one time I told my wife she looked perfect, and she thought I said she looked puffy. But fortunately, she said, huh, and I repeated it, and it was all right. Otherwise, I would not be standing here today, probably. You're trying, if nobody understands you, if there's no language, you have to say, like when I'm in Japan, I was once in Japan, and I just couldn't deal with that language. It just didn't connect to anything, any other language that I knew. And so in Japan, I was like a caveman. And I was saying, and pointing and waving and imitating little animals and things. It seems to me that's how language started. And it's not just seems to me. There's a book called Stephen Mithin called The Singing Caveman. And he suggests that language evolved out of, he calls it HMMMMM, holistic, multimodal, manipulative, musical, and one other M, I forgot what it is, mimetic, imitating things. You know, and that makes sense to me, and it gives you a better grip on words, I think, to have a sense of where they came from, and that words ideally evoke their meaning. Words like queasy and sluggish and rickety, you know, that's not onomatopoeia, but it somehow evokes the meaning. So this book is lots about that and lots of arguments against arbitrariness. Even the word arbitrary is not really arbitrary. I mean, it derives from the word arbiter, which derives from the Latin ad bitere, ad meaning to and bitere meaning to go or to come. So an arbiter was somebody who came or went somewhere in order to settle a dispute. So it's the same kind of word as go-to guy, which we use today. So it was made up out of understandable chunks. And speaking of the word go, would there be any sense at all to saying on the mark, on your mark, get go, set? I don't think so. Go is open-ended, and it makes you want to leap out, whereas set makes you want to set. I don't know. I don't want to insist too much on this, but I do think that language is richer if you are cognizant of its physical connection, its connection to the physical world and to bodily movement, a kinesthetic sort of sense of language. You know, dancers have a kinesthetic sense of their own body, and writers, I think, should have some kinesthetic sense of words. And how a lot of people don't like to think about what goes on in their mouth, and I understand that. But Robert Bixby once referred to the tongue as that awful-looking thing right back of your teeth, and he had a point. But I think for a writer, it's useful to bear in mind how your tongue and the rest of it. I think all English is body English, somehow or another, and the body produces it, or used to produce it until we found ways of letting computers produce it or whatever. So I'll read you a couple of things about some squeaking back there. I'll read you a couple of things. The word Google let me read you my take on Google. I wondered whether anyone had thought to write, quote, "I've Googled so much I'm googly-eyed." So I Googled that expression. Several people had thought to write it. That's one thing Google is good for, checking to see whether something you think of has ever been so well expressed. The downside is it probably has been. For instance, I thought it would be a jolly fresh notion to call this book Writing from Scratch. Scratch is a great word. And it's different from itch. Itch, the more you think about it, scratch is like almost like a tool, and itch is more of a feeling. they go together, I think. But anyway, I Googled the title Writing from Scratch and found that notion to have been around for a while, long enough to have taken on a technical computer code application beyond my area of competence. The founders of Google, who aspire to digitize all human knowledge, have confessed that they spelled their company that way because they didn't realize that Google, G-O-O-G-O-L, is spelled that way. G-O-O-G-O-L, meaning 10 to the 100th power, or 10 duotrigentillion, one tick higher than the figure at which most pocket calculators max out, was coined around 1938 by the late Milton Serrata, who was 9 years old at the time. His uncle, the American mathematician Edward Kasner, had asked Milton to come up with a name for the biggest number he could imagine. When I was a child, and I can say the same of my children in their turn, we would sit around saying, "I'm a jillion times more something than you." "Well, I'm a squillion." "Well, I'm a squillion padillion." Young Milton was better than that. But numbers are made to be topped. If you think a Google is big, how about a Googleplex, which either Milton or more likely his uncle or a colleague came up with after realizing that too much is never enough. A Googleplex is even bigger than a Google, way, way, way bigger, biggly bigger. It's 10 to the Googleth power. At that, Milton and Edward rested. Googleplex, spelled G-O-O-G-L-E, Plex, on the other hand, is the headquarters of Google, G-O-O-G-L-E, in Mountain View, California. I have visited there. It looks like Berkeley in the 60s without any faculty. A form of heaven. No employee is ever more than 100 feet from free food, either a cafeteria, or a fruit stand or a candy stand. There's a sand volleyball court. Let's hope there will never be a need for the word Googleth, as in to the Googleth. Never be a need for the word Googleth, as in to the Googleth power, because it looks like it ought to be Googleth, the archaic third person singular of the verb. He Googleth me to lie down in still water. Getting back to Milton, I assume it was his uncle who decided how to spell Google. G-O-O-G-O-L. Looks vaguely Arabic, maybe, which befits a mathematical term. Algorithm, it comes from an Arabic word, Arabic name. And is also more intimidating. Compare Ghoul, G-H-O-U-L, and Mongol, than Google, G-O-O-G-L-E, which is friendlier, a better household word. Chambers suggests that Chambers' etymological dictionary suggests that Milton Serrata may have been influenced by the comic strip character Barney Google. We don't know that, but let's consider it. Barney was a man, to quote the 1923 hit song tribute to him, with goo-goo googly eyes. Googly presumably derived from goggly-eyed. To goggle is to stare. Goggles are bulgy protective glasses. And so forth. And Shakespeare never used any form of the word Google, but its present participle appears in Huckleberry Finn. The quote, "The Duke he never let on he suspicioned what was up, but just went a-googling around, happy and satisfied, like a jug that's googling out buttermilk." The Duke was communicating in goo-goo noises at that juncture because he was pretending to be mute. Perhaps those noises influenced Huck's choice. Perhaps those noises influenced Huck's choice of words. But if we picture the action of a thick liquid pouring glug, glug, glug out of a jug, we might infer that googling, its admirable onomatopoeia aside, aptly invokes the bobbing of an Adam's apple during prolonged swallowing. The Dictionary of Smoky Mountain English defines google or goozle as the throat, Adam's apple. In 1859, a resident of the Smokies was said to have relished a meal of turnip greens cooked with hog's google. Anyway, you know, the word mum comes from pressing your lips together. You have to have a U in the middle, an between the M's to make it a word, but it's mm is what it is. And mammal. We are mammals. And the word mammal, according to all dictionaries, this is not something I'm just making up for you, comes from mammary gland, and mammary gland comes from mama, comes from baby talk. So the class of animal we are comes from baby talk. And also the word mater comes from the Latin for, you know, mater, for mother. So you know, the substance of the universe, matter, comes from baby talk. The word for mother in the vast majority of languages, I have a list of them here, either starts with the letter M or with a vowel and then the M. And it seems to me, though I can't prove it, that that M sound comes from mmm, for one thing, and yum, and my, oh my, and sock it to me. But it also is your lips when you're nursing, you know, or pressed together. So it might be the first sound babies make. And, you know, so that's not arbitrary. I may have extended it a little too far, but the whole mammal memory thing is not arbitrary. For one thing, I'd say, I don't know what arbitrary means in this. One thing is that in linguistics, they justify calling words arbitrary by invoking pig noise. Steven Pinker points out that in English, pigs go oink. In Norwegian, they go nuff, nuff. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And in, how does he put it? In Russian, he says, Russian pigs go C-H-R-J-O, C-H-R-J-O, which may look arbitrary, but, you know, it's like there was a committee, you know, and the English committee said, okay, what do we call pig noise? We got to get through all the animal noises by, you know, well, I'd like to name it for my Uncle Oink, really. No. We got to get more of a in there. Anyway, but I don't know what he's trying to say. C-H-R-J-O. That's not Russian letters, for one thing. So this is a little bit of research I did. I Googled, quote, Russian pigs go. And sure enough, I obtained the input of an online chat person at ask.metafilter.com named Mr. Anonymous, who sounds like he knows what he's talking about when he writes. In Russians, pigs go H-R-O-O, H-R-O-O. Note that these are rolled R's, and the H is more of a H-K sound, like when you try to build a loogie. Loogie. Don't try to pronounce the K. Just phlegm up the H. So, I guess Russian pigs go sort of like that, you know. It's not oink, but it sounds like a pig to me. You know, people down through the ages have put a lot of work into trying to spell pig noise, and I resent the notion that it's just sort of random. The word grunt, for that matter, works for me. So I'll tell you a story. There are also stories in this book about using words, and I wrote an as-told-to story once with Wilt Chamberlain. I'll read you the story about the story. I'm writing the story, if I can find it. Wilt, in 1974, when I was a staff writer for Sports Illustrated, I was dispatched to Bel Air, California, to co-write a story with a giant. It would be Wilt Chamberlain's announcement, quote, as told to me, that he was retiring as a basketball player. He had been a great one, maybe the greatest, most likely the strongest. Came from Philadelphia, of course. I forgot to mention that. Officially, he was 7'1" tall and weighed 275 pounds, but he looked bigger than that. Starting with rather narrow ankles, he grew wider and wider as he went up, and none of him seemed to be fat. Let me try to put him into perspective. One, I am about 6 feet tall, roughly the same size as Peter Carey, an editor at Sports Illustrated. In pickup basketball, we were about equally forceful on the floor, I would say, which is not saying much, but something. Once Peter was interviewing Dave DeBuscher. DeBuscher was small to be such a great player himself, 6'6", 220 pounds. Peter mentioned that he'd always wondered what it was like under the basket in the NBA, all that bumping and straining for position. By way of response, DeBuscher put the back of his hand against Peter's side and gave him a casual flick that flung him halfway across the room. Once DeBuscher was quoted as saying how close to impossible it was in the aforementioned jostling to budge another great player, Bob Lanier, an inch, in part because Lanier stood 6'11" and weighed 250 pounds and had a tenacious spirit, but also because Lanier's feet, famously, were the biggest feet in basketball, size 22. Four, once Bob Lanier was so persistent in getting between Wilt and the backboard that Wilt lost patience. He grabbed Lanier by the hips, picked him straight up off the floor, feet and all, swung him around, and set him down out of Wilt's way. Five, once Wilt said something to me as we stood side by side in an elevator, and when I turned to reply, I noticed that the part of him that was at my eye level was his elbow. It appeared that there was as much of Wilt above my eye level as below it. Some years later, Wilt added a dimension to his legend by estimating in his second autobiography, A View from Above, that he had had sex with 20,000 women. The editor of that book is my friend and sometime editor, Peter Gathers. When he came to this figure in the manuscript, he called Wilt up and said, Wilt, we've been doing the math here. It worked out to about 9 women a week from age 15 to age 55. Well, said Wilt, there was this one big birthday party. What strikes me as even more impressive is the idea of breaking up with 20,000 women. The word of mouth as to his delicacy must have been pretty good. Another friend of mine had the temerity to ask Wilt how exactly he managed not to crush a sexual partner. I pick her up, put her on the old pole, and spin her around, he said. As a writing partner, he was no less accommodating. Some people are eloquent orally, but when you take down what they say quite faithfully and look at it in cold print, a great deal has been lost. Wilt, on the other hand, sounded like himself on the page, cogent, forthcoming, grammatical. All I had to do was ask him questions, take down his answers, and do some nipping, tucking, and reorganizing. There was only one problem. This was not Wilt's first as-told-to experience, and he felt that the last one he had done for Sports Illustrated had misrepresented him in some regards, notably in the headline. He was doing this story on the strict condition that every word be subject to his approval. He signed off on the body of the story without a quibble. But now we were sitting in his Mountain Eyrie in Bel Air awaiting the headline. His home, I should mention, was appropriately large. Its ceilings were cathedralish. Its views empyrean. Its decor included an element that I haven't seen in any other home. Wolf muzzles. Wilt's decorator had acquired a considerable quantity of fur patches from the muzzles of wolves. I wish, in retrospect, that I had inquired into their provenance, but I didn't. Sewn together, they formed a herringbone pattern. Wilt had wolf muzzle carpets, and he had wolf muzzle upholstery. I'm sure it was a roadkill wolves. He also had several friends on hand who were not as large as he was, but were large enough to be his friends, and they had taken it upon themselves to protect Wilt from being taken advantage of, as told to Wise again. As we awaited the headline, they milled about, eyeing me narrowly from time to time. Back then, in the pre-computer and even pre-fax age, the transmission of journalistic copy was not instantaneous. Many is the wee hour I spent driving with my typewritten story to an all-night Western Union office, or reading out 2,500 words or so, with punctuation and spelling of unusual words, to a Western Union operator over the phone. By this time, technology had advanced to the point that you could carry around a big, bulky mojo machine, as Hunter Thompson called it, that plugged into a phone outlet. You'd stick your typescript into it, and very slowly, line by line, it would send a copy to SI's offices in Manhattan. In this case, it was very slowly bringing from those offices the headline that an editor had written. Wilt was calm as usual, but his friends were pacing back and forth. The page finished appearing. I pulled it out of the machine. The main headline was, "My impact will be everlasting." Of this, Wilt approved. He had said it, and it was commensurate with his stature. But when I looked at the subhead, I thought, uh-oh. "A dominant force in the NBA," it said, "is retiring from the game." I handed it to Wilt. He read it aloud. His friends looked aghast. "A dominant force?" Wilt asked me. "Well," I said, "I think the operative words there are dominant and force. And you were certainly a dominant," he said. And his friends were wandering around glaring at me and muttering, "A dominant? The man was dominant. There ain't no A to it." "You perhaps prefer the dominant," I said to Wilt, and he nodded. One problem with that was there were other dominant forces in the NBA. Another was that "the" would make that line too long to fit the space. So I called the editor, who had left. Fortunately, SI had a great switchboard operator, Muriel. She was aware of her invaluability and did not take any guff from anyone. Once SI's imperious, hard-drinking French managing editor, André Laguerre, who had served with Charles de Gaulle during World War II, slammed his phone down. After a beat, it rang again. André's secretary picked it up. She called in André. "It's Muriel, for you," she said. "André," said Muriel, "if everybody in the building whanged his receiver, I would have to have brain surgery." So, Andrew never whanged his receiver again. What Muriel could do that made her position so secure was she could somehow find anybody, wherever they were, and patch them into a conversation. This she did with the editor who had written the A-dominant subhead. Unfortunately, she had found him in the Ho-Ho, a Chinese restaurant and bar that had two features that appealed to Sports Illustrated editors. One, it was right next to the Time Life building, where SI was located. And two, every fourth drink was free. So it didn't hardly pay when you think about it not to have eight. And the editor was into about his sixth or seventh as I told him, "I'm here with Wilt, and we got the headlines. The main one is fine, but the subhead, he doesn't like a dominant. He thinks the dominant would..." The editor answered me in a way that was all the more frustrating because it sounded sort of like human speech. Thing of it, dominant. "I'm here with Wilt," I said, and he was looking way down at me as I sat on the couch, and there were guys walking around shaking their heads going, "Thing I don't see, you come into a man's home and call him A-dominant." And the wolf muzzles were bristling underneath me. And I couldn't get anything coherent out of the editor. "I'm sorry, Wilt," I said. You're gonna have to talk to him." I passed the phone way up to Wilt, and he made his case, invoked his contractual right. Somehow he seemed to be having a conversation with the editor. "Yes, I'm aware of what dominant and force mean. That's not the point. The point is, well, yes, I know that. But, gradually, to my astonishment, I heard Wilt being mollified. "All right, okay," he said, and he handed me the phone. The line was dead. "Who the hell is Muriel?" he said. So, does anyone have any questions over what we've covered or what we haven't covered? If you do, hold up your hand and someone will, a library staffer, I'll be bound, will, with a name tag and everything, will hand you a microphone. Oh, there's one. I didn't see one. Oh, well, first this lady back here.
"Did you keep your mother and father in stitches when you were young?"
I think mothers and fathers are hard to keep in stitches, I would say. I write in here about consonants and vowels. And my father was a consonant person. You know, he'd be down in his workshop in the basement rattling hardware, you know, sort of clickety noises. And my mother was a vowel person. She'd be saying, "Oh." So they... But my mother taught me to read early on and taught me to read phonetically, you know, which is not all that simple in English, as we all know, but it was formative. And also she would read to me from Uncle Remus stories, dialect stories, which have a certain, sociological difficulty to them. I mean, inappropriateness to them. But the stories themselves are old, taken from African stories, and they are, the words are spelled out, not like the dictionary, but for instance, the word, which is a condensation of an expression, bimeby, B-I-M-E-B-Y, bimeby, meaning by and by. I just love that. It's a little bit like, in texting today and online, people use the word "ight," A-I-G-H-T, "ight," instead of "all right." I think there ought to be an apostrophe in it, it's a little fussy that way.
Yes, many of us are familiar with you through Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And we all enjoy the show and enjoy you on the show. We'd like to hear a few comments about your activity on the show and maybe a little story or two to go with it.
Yeah, you heard the question, I guess, that asking about Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It's a fun show to do. It's not. I hate O'Hare Airport, but other than that, because I have to go to Chicago to do it. Usually, sometimes we do it in other cities. But I used to do it out of my house, and everybody was scattered all around different studios, and I had insisted on having it in my house, and so I had these earphones and everything, all this cool stuff, and. The problem was that I live up in the country in Massachusetts, and our phone system was so antiquated that even with all the fancy NPR equipment, well, fancy and NPR is sort of a an oxymoron, but, it was pretty much professional equipment. I was a little bit delayed. I would say something, and then a little bit later it would be heard. So I would have to start talking before I knew what I was going to say, just to get anything in, word in edgewise. But now we do it in front of an audience, which is more fun, and it's good to see people. And, we went through everybody who's on the air for NPR as our special guests. And now anybody will be on it. We've had both McCain and Obama on as guests. Obama was there in person because he lives in Chicago. And he said that when he showed up at the first day in the Senate, he learned to his surprise that every senator has a little desk, and it's sort of like a school desk. And senators down through the centuries have carved their names into the into their desks. And I said, are you supposed to do that? And he said, well, he thought that as the only African-American senator, he would spray paint his name on there. But it's fun, and we all get along. Yeah. Man over here.
As a good Southerner, I wanted to know, in your research for this book, if there are phrases or words that you kind of uncovered that you wish that were brought back, that we were using more often.
Oh. Well, I refer frequently to the Dictionary of Smoky Mountain English, which has a lot of, it should be in every home. It's just full of wonderful things. There's a term in there, a chicken wobble, which I never had heard of, but apparently is still, it's a sort of social occasion that's still held in up in the mountains of Appalachia and Smoky Mountains. And what a chicken wobble is it's all men, and they get together and eat fried chicken. And a big part of the charm of it is that nobody knows whose chicken they're eating, because the tradition is to go around and steal chicken from one of the people who are at the party. And so you may be eating your own stolen chicken, and you won't know till you get home. I don't know whether I want to revive that tradition or not, but I think that being Southern is one thing that makes me interested in the pronunciation of words, and which is true of lots of people from alien cultures. since I pronounce things differently than say, I don't know, Brian Williams or something, it makes me aware. Another thing is that my very name, is not pronounced phonetically. It's spelled Blount, and therefore should probably be pronounced Blount, but it goes way back to England, and it's pronounced Blunt. So I've always been sort of, and then I was, always, and it's not a great, not a very musical name either. I once played baseball with some Venezuelan. There was a New York baseball team, press team, made up of New York sports writers. We played some Venezuelan sports writers in baseball, and there was a banquet afterwards, and the Venezuelans had this, I don't remember the words, but the Venezuelans had a chant that they would do, sort of a tribute to each of us players, and it was hip, and then they would name the name of a player, and then so it went Pepe, and they were applauded, and Dooley, you know, all these names, and then they came to me, and it was Blanc. just not a musical name. But is that, am I still answering the question or no? Yeah. So.
What's your least favorite word?
My least favorite word. Well, I criticize some words in here because they just don't come anywhere near sounding like what they ought to mean. One word is temesis, T-M-E-S-I-S, which is a term for when you stick something in the middle of a word like absolutely or guarantee you, you know. It's a rhetorical term, and it's from the Greek. But it's just jammed together. It ought to be tweenesis or something, you know. It ought to evoke what it is, and it just seems like the opposite of what it is, and it really makes me. I also am tired of hearing certain words like awesome. Awesome's got water. I hear kids talking in the subway, and they'll say, "I don't think he's so awesome anymore. He's not." So it's like awesome is like okay now, I guess, or something. And a word that I use too much, there are several words that I use too much. One of them is just. I just do it. I don't know why. I just do, you know. And amazing. Amazing has somehow become the word for extraordinary or wonderful or far out. Or everybody says amazing all the time. And I think it's because it's got zing in it, you know. It also has that long A. It's a fun word to say. Words like bust and stuff have lots of different meanings because people like to use them, you know, and it's fun to say bust. Yeah, I'll tell you a great word to say. It's two words, I guess. Polyurethane foam. Isn't that nice? It sort of uses every part of your mouth. So Tamesis I'm down on, and also incredible. People say incredible. You know, they say she's an incredible role model. Well, that means a role model you don't believe in. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
I don't know how to explain the larger structure of this question, so you'll have to help me out, please. I'll just, like, throw it out there, right, and you try and respond.
Well, that's usually what we do here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you're so good at it.
I'm bracing myself.
Yeah, and you swim in this stuff. It's great. I heard somebody use the phrase, do you know? And I realized, do you know? And I realized that there'd been a word dropped all the time. It's like, you know?
You know.
You know?
Like, you know.
Do you know?
Yeah.
And it was surprising to me to recognize this word had been gone, and I'd never missed it.
Oh.
And
where did it go?
Yeah, and then can you give an example of things that maybe are structured that way that you could just think of like that?
Words that just disappear in the way things are pronounced. Well, Woody Allen, in one of the Woody Allen movies, he's talking about he hears anti-Semitic things all the time. Said, the other day, people were talking at the table next to me, and somebody said, Jeet yet? And the other one said, no, Jew. So we've lost a couple of dids in there, I guess. And I don't know where those words go, but people will, as long as it's intelligible, people will shorten things. And that's sort of healthy, I think, to get get as tight as brevity is the soul of wit. Yeah.
Since you already referred to this, what's your feeling about the introduction of texting spelling?
Well, there's a quote. I found one. I don't know where I found it. There is an online dictionary called UrbanDictionary.com, which I recommend if you're children use a word that you don't understand and you're sure you want to know what it means, you can go to UrbanDictionary.com, and it's different from Wikipedia, because Wikipedia is constantly being rewritten, you know. But how UrbanDictionary.com works is anybody can write in, as long as it's not abusive, you know, can write in a definition of any given word, and whether it can, then somebody else can write their definition, and so you have all these competing definitions, and people vote up or down on them. So it's a kind of democratic, and it actually has it tends to be that the more cogent definitions rise to the top. It sort of works, and the word somewhere in there, the word awesome, somebody said, is now being shortened in texting to awes, A-W-E-S. That seems to me even worse than awesome. And texting, I mean, there's some, it's an interesting, my thumbs are too big to text. I just can't do it. But so it's going to pass me. And it's also too bad. I also thought of calling this book The Joy of Text. But there's actually a word now, called a book about called The Joy of Text, which is about texting. And so it's too bad. And then there are all these sort of abbreviations and, you know, R-O-F-L, R-O-F-L-M-A or something like that. Rolling on the floor laughing my ass off. It's sort of ingenious, but if, you know, it's not really language. Yes, sir.
Nimis.
About what?
Nimis.
Nimis? What's that?
No, near-ness?
Near-miss. Huh? Near-miss. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. The expression near-miss. Well, it's pretty much, idiom, I think, established in the in the language. You just, it's like a close call, you know, a close, I don't, that doesn't bother me. Does it bother you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it says you almost missed, but you must have hit.
Yeah. Well, I guess you're right, logically. But I'm trying to, it's like a close, yeah. Yeah. Shall we vote on it? All right. Who doesn't like near miss? Who likes it? Who are undecided? Yeah. Yeah. Yes, sir. Yes. One more. Okay.
What about these words like virtually that seem to be very get soft in their meaning?
Virtually.
Virtually. Or virtually. Literally.
Literally, yeah. Well, literally is all, is virtually, yeah, is just sort of, you don't know what it means, really. But, and it's a sloppy word, I think. Literally is used sloppily all the time. Say, I literally fell through the floor, you know. Which is the opposite of what is meant, you know. I figuratively fell through the floor would be all right, but it's, literally is just used to mean, you know, just sort of an intensifier that doesn't mean anything, and that gets my goat. Yeah. One more, I guess. Here you go.
Okay. Hi, Roy. Are you still in the Stranger Than Fiction group? And could you tell us a little bit about who's in it and what you guys do?
I am in an author's band called the Rock Bottom Remainders, and we and some other people who couldn't sing put out an album called Stranger Than Fiction, yeah, and I sang Roly Poly on it really badly. The only part of my rendition that I liked of Roly Poly, which I love, a song which I love, but I can't stand to hear myself singing, was. At the end it says, it's all about a little fat kid who eats everything all day and he's daddy's little fatty. And the last line is, Betty's going to be a man someday. It sounded like Betty's going to be a man someday. So I said, how about Veronica? It's an author's band with Stephen King, Dave Barry, Mitch Albom, Amy Tan. Barbara Kingsolver used to be in it, but she got a life. And Redley Pearson and James McBride sometimes, and Frank McCourt has appeared with us some. And Bruce Springsteen played with us once in L.A. on Gloria. I'm the least musical member of the band, which... We used to have a thing called the Critics Chorus, which included Matt Groening of The Simpsons and various rock critics, and we were there to make it clear that we didn't think we were any good, and because we certainly weren't. We would sing short shorts. Remember short shorts? And we wear short shorts, and we would drop our pants, and that's. But the most of the critics have dropped out. On Gloria, I will sing the title, you know, spell it out and stuff like that. And on Wild Thing, I will come in with You Move Me, you know. I will do that, and I do some sort of eccentric dancing sometimes when I. Get the spirit. It's a lot of fun. We're going to appear in Miami next month, I guess, in November at the Miami Book Fair, because Dave Barry lives down there, and he and Ridley Pearson are pretty much the organizers. It's a great thing, but it's hard to get everybody together. We're literally all over the country. Amy's in San Francisco. Dave's in Miami, and Steve's in Stephen King's. And one thing about being in a band with Stephen King is that. You look down and somebody, this literally happened somewhere, there were three or four young women who had apparently put oil or some kind of flammable liquid in their long fingernails and were holding up burning fingers. It's a little disconcerting to sing to burning fingers. We stop. This is, it is literally true that we, that we stopped, the bus broke down once. We were traveling in Aretha Franklin's bus, I'll have you know. And the bus broke down, and we pulled into a rest area there while the driver called for help. And Stephen King walked out, and somebody came up to him with a copy of The Stand and asked him to autograph it. Just happened to be waiting there just in case Stephen King said... Okay. Thank you all very much.
Folks, please join us upstairs. We'll be there as quick as a hiccup. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.